No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. We have a special guest tonight, someone who's been on the show before. I'm one of her big fans, Jeanette Rose Barris. I would go over her bio, but it's so extensive that we would run out of time. And I think that everybody knows this lady. She writes for several people. She's a freelance writer who is an author and covers both national and local politics. So we're so happy to have her on the show tonight. Thanks for being on, Jeanette. Welcome again.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Brown, for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be on your show.
Oh, that's so sweet of you to say. But let's start. This is an issue that was dear to my heart these days. I went to an event yesterday in Ward 1, and I was riding through Ward 1 to get to the event, and I saw signs up that said, recall, don't sign the petition. And then other signs that said, recall Nadeau. So I know in March you wrote an article about this. What do you think about this recall? We've never had a recall successful in Washington, have we?
No, there hasn't been one. But I think recalls, or at least the attempt of a recall, indicates that there's great dissatisfaction among residents and the electorate. I mean, you can remember when the governor of California was recalled, and he managed to keep his job, however, because the people who ended up running against him were, pretty poor candidates. But it was a similar level of dissatisfaction in that state with the way he was managing the state. And so in this case, the real issue that people have is, and I think it's a legitimate issue, is the concern about crime. And what was the role that elected officials played by the policies that they enacted? And if you know, right after the George Floyd murder, there was a real campaign, national campaign to defund the police. The council members here, Charles Allen in Ward 6 and Breanne Nadeau in Ward 1, among others, I think it was the entire council, actually, that actually began to have this discussion and did vote in the budget to reduce the police department's budget by at least $15 million. They also refused to provide funding for the cadet program, which is basically the training program for district residents who want to become, they're in school and they want to become police officers. And they also voted to gradually reduce the school officers. These are the police officers that are
resource officers. Yeah.
Resource officers, yes. And so a lot of people have believed that sort of, and then there were other things, other policies, the one where they refused to allow Metro to actually find people who were or arrest people who were jumping the turnstile, the fare gate. And so there were a number of actions that the council took that many people believe created a lawlessness or a sense of lawlessness in the city, and it led to what we're seeing now, or what we saw, so sort of building up actually through the pandemic and reaching its height post-pandemic in 2023.
Well, and the police department is down about 20%. I think that bothers a lot of people that we don't have, you know, we don't have the same number of cops on the street that we used to. And I, you know, the George Floyd thing, that shocked everybody, right? I mean, we actually saw this man murdered on whoever took the video. We actually witnessed it, all of us. And it was horrid. And yes, the optics were so bad. But now the optics are bad in the district. We now have two 13-year-olds and a 12-year-old girl, three girls, 13 and 12, who kicked a man to death, a homeless man, in an alley and took a video of it. I mean, I've lived in the district for 35 years, Janetta, and I've never encountered anything that horrible.
Well, we don't know what happened. If you go back,
we don't know all the facts. Yeah, I should say that.
No, I wasn't going to say that. I was actually going to say, when you say you never encountered anything, we don't know who the people were who killed the woman in on H Street, remember.
Yes.
Back in the 80s, when there was a crack epidemic,
there were
a number of crimes that were going on, and some of these crimes were being committed by juveniles, and some of the drug problems actually were also being committed by juveniles. So I think there's been that history of the problem is that it is the level that we've seen here is very significant, and it's not just, you know, being a lookout for somebody who's a drug dealer and you're the lookout. It's major crime. It's felony crime, really, and these kids are not being charged with felony crime. But you know, Senator Brown, one of the things that I say is that everything is connected. And when you look at your government, you have to look at the government in a holistic way. You can't just look at the policies. Well, you look at the policies that, you know, the legislature has introduced and approved. You look at the way that the executive branch is actually implementing those laws and the fidelity that is being applied to the implementation. You look at how your workers in the executive branch are dedicated to the task that they're being given. And when I look at the problems with youth in the city, I go back to my reporting from 2018, where I did an investigative series about the unresolved trauma among children in the district, and the fact that there were very few therapists and psychologists and even social workers in the schools that were dealing with these kids. And so these kids were going through the school system traumatized by things that were happening in their community, things that were happening in their own family. That trauma was exacerbated during the pandemic, where you had people dying in their families, serious deaths, serious fear and concerns about how people were going to make it because jobs were lost. People couldn't go to work or didn't go to work. There was all that going on. I even asked the woman who is our Dr. Bazron, Barbara Bazron, who is over mental health, whether she saw any correlation between the rising crime that we started witnessing in 2020 and the pandemic, she said that they had not done any corollary studies to show the correlation between the trauma of the pandemic and how that was being expressed, or whether that was whether what we were seeing with crime was an expression of that trauma. We now know that some of it is related to that. Not all of it, but some of it certainly is.
Well, I think that's very true, and I want to stand corrected. It's amazing to me that you brought up the thing on where the woman was brutally murdered in the middle of the afternoon on 8th Street in an alley, because I looked at an apartment across the street from where that happened, like four or five doors down.
Yeah.
And when it happened, I moved to another part. I moved to Southeast over by on 8th Street because of that.
Right.
But yeah, this is one of the things when you get old, you forget things. But yes, that's very true. That was a
not that I'm much younger than you, but we've had some horrific crimes, but it is part of urban living, and so I don't want to. Yeah. But I don't want to dismiss it by saying it's part of urban living, but. But urban living, you have these kind of behaviors, unfortunately. And the last part of this thing that I wanted to mention about juvenile crime is that we have a failing child welfare system in this city. And I don't think that the mayor just recently, she introduced her truancy legislation, and she tasked the Department of Human Services with implementing most of this legislation. That's the job of the Child and Family Services Agency, rather, that's the formal name. She gave that to the Department of Human Services, which is already overwhelmed. And so I think that's when you see the government doing that, you know that it's just broken. And so our government is broken. It's not just the police department. It's all aspects of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the thing that gets me, Janetta, is when you talk about the Metro fare jumpers, for example. They passed that rule. They decriminalized it 2 years ago. Now they're passing a law to criminalize it and increase the penalties. And you almost want to say to them, hey, you're surprised that you decriminalized jumping over the turnstiles and now people are jumping over the turnstiles?
Exactly.
And they're doing the same thing. The mayor came out last week and criticized this bill that they passed, the Policing Act of 2022, where, you know, they said that police officers couldn't use their body camera to fill out reports and stuff like that. And police left because of that.
Right.
They brought many cops back on retirement. In fact, at the event I was, there was a retired cop who's now on the beat again. They brought many of these policemen back. And now many of them have to be released because of the Policing Act of 2020 that says
right.
if you've ever been charged with anything, including insubordination.
Oh my God,
if I could have been fired for insubordination, I probably would have been fired from every job I ever had.
I
agree with you. The government's broken.
Yeah. And I agree with you, too. If insubordination is grounds for dismissal, my God, I would have been dismissed. Well, I was dismissed many places, but that was my choice and not theirs, but
right.
you know, so I think you're right about that. I think the point that you're making is that we have people making laws, and I call it knee-jerking.
Yes.
You know, something happens in the world, and in the world, because George Floyd was not killed in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so something happens in the world, and these legislators here think that they have to respond to something that's happening someplace outside of our jurisdiction, and then when they do pass something that does affect what is happening within the interior of D.C. They don't think about the long-term impact. If we do A, B is going to happen. And if B happens, what is the result of that, the consequences? There's a consequence to every law that we pass. And it doesn't seem like elected officials here understand that.
Well, and you know that when I was in business for myself, over my desk I had a quote from a famous economist that said, in the long run, we're all dead. Because that's the mantra of small business, right? You're always looking at next week, next month, right? Yeah. You're not looking at 10 years down the road. And I think that's especially true in politics. They have a hard time seeing past the end of their nose.
Yeah.
We have tons of money that we're pouring into education, and we still have a bad education system because they put it into administrators and do things like you just talked about, giving them money to the wrong people, and they don't do enough wraparound services for these kids. You know that I'm a high school dropout because of the trauma in my life, and I had a sister who was just a badass that wasn't going to let me fail. Convinced me to get a GED. I got into community college, et cetera, worked all my way up to a master's, graduating with a master's degree from the University of Maryland. But I often say nobody drops out of high school because they can't do the work. They drop out of high school because of the trauma in their lives. And, you know, when I started 18 years ago as a senator, 51% of the students at Anacostia High School didn't finish on time. I just couldn't believe that more, you know, what does the principal say on the first day of school? You've got more chance of failing than you do of succeeding. I mean, it's just horrible. And I see so many of these children go, you know, their lives being wasted over this stuff. And you're right. It exists everywhere. And we are knee-jerk about it. So let me ask you, one thing I think people don't realize about politics is there's a difference between campaigning and governing. You know, you can be a great campaigner and a crappy governor or senator or congressman, right? You can be great at, well, Donald Trump, you know, you can convince people.
I was getting ready to say that.
Right, of what they want to hear. But then you actually have to run. You actually have to run stuff and get to train. So tell me what you think of this. I think Muriel Bowser is a great campaigner, but I'm not sure she's a good mayor.
I think we should have term limits in the city. You may recall that residents actually did vote for term limits, and then the council overturned what the residents had voted for. But I do think that generally, when you get to your third term, unless you have some really innovative, powerful ideas, you need to move aside because somebody else should be taking that seat. I like Mayor Muriel Bowser. I really like her as a person. But I'm not sure that I think that she and almost everyone else in her administration is burned out. And why wouldn't we think that? They went through 3 years of a pandemic, and managing that alone, it was stressful. It required dealing with all kinds of circumstances that no one had envisioned, because no one in our age or their age group had ever experienced a pandemic.
Right.
And then you had to deal with a pandemic with a jackass in the White House.
Yeah.
And so I think that you know, and all the other things, the George Floyd, the pandemic, now the city dealing with basically a financial crisis. These are major issues that are being dealt with by the mayor and the council. And it's not surprising to me that sometimes they act and look burned out, because it would burn out, the average person would be burned out from those experiences. And she has, in the course of her three terms, she's dealt with quite a bit of things. And the same could be said for the chairman. I mean, last year, at the beginning of Phil Mendelson's term, I asked whether something was going on with him, because he was not behaving in the way that I thought was responsible. He wasn't being a responsible politician, a responsible leader. And so I raised that in a piece that I wrote in the D.C. Line. And so, yes, I think that, you know, they should have said, okay, let somebody else pick it up from here because we've done enough. So I'm not impressed. I am not impressed with any of the political leaders now. I might like them, but I'm not impressed by their leadership.
And we don't have any, it seems to me that we don't have anybody in the wings. We don't have anybody stepping up to the plate.
Well,
like, who would run against Muriel if she decides to run in 2024? I mean, I don't see anybody out there.
Well, she would be running in 2026. Yeah.
Oh, she was elected in 2022, right.
So, but what kind of person do you think should run against her?
I don't know. I think somebody, you know, I think that, you know, there are people that say times makes a person. Abraham Lincoln was the right person for the right time. Winston mm-hmm. Churchill was the right person for the right time. FDR was the right person for the right time. I think we need to find the right person. We had Anthony Williams, for example. Anthony mm-hmm. Williams was a bean counter, and he was somebody that was looked at the fine print, right, and was very good at managing things. Mm-hmm. And that's what we needed at the time. I think we need somebody, I'll tell you, I think we need somebody like Joe Biden that's 40 years younger.
I think we need another Anthony Williams, actually.
Not the most personable person, right? Not that he wasn't a nice guy and all, but Muriel has way more personality than he did, and she's much more of a politician, right? And people like her more. But he was the right guy for the right time. So I don't know who I would put in that position, but I think somebody with a strong background in management and somebody that's tough. I worry about this administration being able to stand up to the people that try to bully them. And a lot of people try to bully us, including Congress. But should we have paid $500 million to keep the hockey and basketball team in town?
Oh, don't ask me that question because, first I want to go to one thing and then I'll come back to Ted Leonsis. But I think that the city at this moment in time needs a real visionary. People don't give Anthony Williams and his team the right credit. I think he was a bean counter when he came in, but mm-hmm. he blossomed into the position and he had the right people around him. He wasn't afraid to get people who were more experienced than he and people who had broader knowledge. And so, consequently, he had a team of people who dreamed big and actually realized a good portion of their dreams. Here, people dream, what we have now are people who dream small, very small, and they can't even realize most of those small dreams. And that's troubling to me.
Excuse me, but that's the key to leadership, isn't it? I think a great leader, rather than accomplishing things, inspires the people around him
exactly.
to accomplish things. Yeah.
Exactly. I agree with you. And so with respect to, and so because we don't have big dreamers, because we don't have people who can pivot and move and who are nimble, at a time when we need just those traits, then Ted Leonsis becomes so more important to the city than he should have been. And I personally do not like the man because I think that he actually bullies. He has bullied the city into spending money every 2 or 3 years on his operation. And now somebody who came and was getting ready to, you know, speaking from a woman's perspective, it's like having your husband have an affair in your face, and then the woman he had the affair with decided she wanted to break it off, and he comes running back to you.
Right. Well,
that's that's sort of the way Ted Leonsis has handled this city, and we have been so thankful that he came back, that we've designed all these different, and we're going through all these different contortions to make sure he gets more money than he should be getting, because the press release at least says $515 million. It is going than that.
Where was he going to go? That's a great analogy.
Exactly.
Because the Virginians, like the old lover, the Virginians threw him out. Right? The Virginia legislature stopped the deal. So what was he going to do? He was going to take the team back to Maryland? I don't think so.
No, Maryland didn't want him either. Right. They had already told him, don't come here because we're not going to take you. And so they weren't going to spend their money on him. Because he's a difficult person to deal with.
Right.
He always wants more and more and more and more and more. He's never satisfied.
Well, if it were me, I would say, well, maybe you guys should go over and play at the Dunbar Gym or something.
Yes.
You know, if it's not working out for you downtown. Now, we all know that it was an important anchor in Chinatown, and I don't dismiss that it was an important economic engine. But, yeah, it seems like we were giving away the store. And, you know, the council often gets lambasted for being in the pocket of developers because it seems that, to a lot of people anyway, I don't know how true this is, you would know better than I do, that developers do the same thing. They bully the government into doing what they want them to do.
And, well, that's because the government doesn't have, the district government has no self-appreciation, no self-respect.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's hard to have self-respect, right, when the national legislature tells you you're second-class citizens. But absolutely, and you know what I think? I live in Ward 3, and I think the people in Ward 1s, 2, and 3, the people with money, the people with power, are more focused on national politics. I think the average person in my neighborhood could tell you more about Hillary Clinton than they could tell you about Muriel Bowser. We really don't focus on it either, which allows them to have free reign. I mean, $22 billion budget, I think we should. Every time I drive through Anacostia, I say to myself, why haven't we done more down here? I sit on the board of a nonprofit that puts hundreds of thousands of dollars a year into Anacostia. And I wonder why we haven't done more down here. You know? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, what more would you want them to do?
Well, if you want Anacostia to grow and flourish, I think you need to put businesses over there that people want to go to. I think it's so insular. I mean, on the one hand, when I go over there, there's more of a sense of community in Ward 8 than any other ward that I go to. But people in my neighborhood never go over there. People in, you know, and I think that's what you have to do if you want to make it vibrant. I mean, one grocery store in all of Ward 8, and Janetta, from my house, there are four Whole Foods within a mile of my house. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think you need to do that. You need more economic development over there. And you need to take care of the problem with kids in the schools. You know, every one of my kids went to what was Wilson High School. It's now been renamed. But all their friends went to college. All three of my children went to college.
Yeah.
Then I see some of my children's friends got into Princeton, Harvard, Yale. And then I see that we have the lowest SAT scores in America, the lowest SAT scores in America. Mm. So I say to myself, how low must the scores be coming out of Anacostia, Beloit, Dunbar, schools like that, that to bring down that average? You know what I mean?
And, well, the two issues here that you're talking mm-hmm. about, one is community development and how yes. do you develop a community. The other one, I think, is a bit more difficult of to tackle, and that is education, because you're dealing with cultural traditions, you're right. dealing with socioeconomic factors, you're dealing with Brown versus Board of Education, you're dealing with enslavement, and so you have those. I think you have a rippling effect of all those disadvantages, and it's not that you can't overcome the disadvantages, but you have to have a plan and a system that you implement and that people are faithful to in their implementation and continuation. I think that's part of the problem. Adrian Fenty came in and said, I want the mayor to be in charge of schools. And when Adrian right. Fenty was the mayor, he was in charge of schools. Yes. Trust me, I followed the guy around. The moment Vincent Gray became mayor, he turned most of the activities and the decision-making and everything to his deputy mayor. And after he came in, Muriel Bowser then made her deputy mayor, whom I think is wholly inadequate and should be fired, should have been fired a long time ago. She made him, and then she built up the office with more staff than Adrian Fenty's deputy had, Vincent Reynoso. And so what happened is that the mayor's in charge of education in name only. The mayor's not actively engaged in the education systems in this city. And therefore, you don't get the attention and you get the money, but you don't get the real kind of attention, the intimate involvement with parents, with principals, and everything that I think many people had hoped would come with mayoral control.
Well, and you can't overestimate the comment you made about it being cultural as well, and going back to things like Brown versus Board of Education. You can't overemphasize that stuff. People often ask me, what was it that motivated you to go from a high school dropout to get a college education? And I say, it's because it was what was expected of me and my family.
Exactly. You know,
if I had gone back to my grandmother and said, I found a way to make $10 million, the first thing she would have said to me was, good, now you can go back to school and get an education.
Right.
right? So much of it is cultural and so much of it is historical. But you're right. I think we put the money in the wrong place and sometimes put it in the wrong hands. And this is definitely a all hands on deck thing in Anacostia, yeah. especially is the kids down there and the education and the opportunities. I don't think many of these kids see a future. They don't.
Well,
even my kids don't see. You know, I tell my kids I found my first job out of college by looking in the newspaper. And they laugh.
You can't do that now. You can't do that now.
You go, Dad, you don't do it that way. You turn in 10,000 resumes on the internet and hope that you get a
Exactly. I don't even know a newspaper that's actually, well, yeah, you got to go on the internet. I mean, I guess the Post does classifieds and City Paper does classifieds, but it's not. It's definitely not that way now.
Yeah, not jobs.
Yeah.
Dogs for sale. $7,000 Shih Tzu for sale. That's what they advertise. You know, I don't think I've ever paid more than $25. I've always had a dog in my life, and I don't think I've ever paid more than $25 for one.
Oh,
but
I wanted to say something about the first thing that you brought up, which was, you know, in Anacostia, what? I remember. What's his name? Arrington Dixon.
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s, Arrington Dixon, when he was he founded the Anacostia Coordinating Council, and he was in charge. I think maybe Phil Pinnell was
Pinnell,
still working with him now. Phil is now the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
But Arrington did a study. He actually had a study. I think it was Dean Rusk's son actually did the study. And the study was about how to actually enhance the economic status of people in east of the river. Because I don't say Anacostia because it's Anacostia, right. Congress Heights, Bellevue. Yes. It's all these different neighborhoods. It's the community east of the river. And so so he did this study, and the study basically said you need to deliberately create a mixed-income community east of the river. Yeah. And there was a methodology that was recommended. A lot of people really went after Arrington Dixon about that. But that is the only way that if you can't continue to dump all the affordable housing, all of the government buildings where people come in, go to work, and go home. They don't stay. They don't live there, okay, in many instances. And so that income even doesn't stay in that community. That income goes someplace else, usually Maryland or Virginia. And so... And so while the city thinks that it's doing well, basically what it's doing is it's not investing the way it should be investing in this community. And when it does invest and build all this affordable housing, and so you have mostly low-income people living in that community, the way businesses operate, they're looking at who's going to buy our product.
Right.
Who's going to come to Whole Foods when getting chicken? Getting a whole chicken is probably going to cost you $10 or more, and then it's organic, and then you know all these other issues. And so I think that what happens is that the city isn't really investing and creating an environment where people like your neighbors might want to move over there or live over there or go to a restaurant over there because they don't believe that it's possible.
Well, I agree with you. And you know, one of the great examples of that is that I lived in North New Jersey, and some great politicians came up with the idea that they could build more affordable housing units if they built high-rises. So much like Cabrini Green in Chicago, they built a series of high-rises in a three-block square area. And what they did was they consolidated all the social problems into one neighborhood and all the poor people into one neighborhood. And everybody moved out. Nobody wanted a part of it.
Yeah.
So I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. And the mayor continuously rejects the idea of real mixed income housing. The folks who proposed that the city spend $140 million. $140 million. That's how much the property was being sold. The Wardman Hotel was being sold or auctioned at a, you know, the starting auction was about $140 million. Okay, so maybe they would have gone to $200 million. We just spent we just agreed to invest $515 million so she doesn't want to, she didn't want to do that. Matthew Freeman, the Ward 3 council member, mm-hmm. offers or suggests, why don't you get the Intel Stat building on Connecticut Avenue? There's so much that you could do with Intel Stat. That property
right.
was
it's a gigantic property. Yeah.
Exactly. She poo-pooed that idea. Then some other residents, who are part of this citywide housing coalition in DuPont Circle, they suggested, why don't you buy the Harrington Hotel? You could make that into workforce housing. It is, after all, a hotel. It would be much easier to convert than an office building.
Right, it would be. And why is that, Jeanette? Do you think it's motivated by the fact that all of us nice white people over here in Ward 3 and Ward 1 and Ward 2 and half of Ward 4, we don't want those poor people? You think that's what it's about? And that's where
council get their money? It's the poor. It's the white people in Ward 1 and Ward 3 and Ward 2 who are coming up with these ideas for innovative uses of buildings and properties where you could have mixed income, so you can bring in poor people and or working class people to live at the Wardman. And they had actually developed an entire plan that would have involved family styled housing and retail, and also, you know, luxury housing. So you have all that together. When I was growing up in the South and living in what we call in Pontchartrain Park, which was middle class, working class, there were richer people certainly than my grandparents living right up the block from us. So there were places in the South where you had, you know, doctors and lawyers and people who were really making money at that time, living not far or right next to sometimes people who were on welfare. So the apartments were, or the housing itself, was a mixed-income neighborhoods. And what happened in those mixed-income neighborhoods were people like myself, you know, I learned from people who were more economically in the higher economic class. And so some of that was encouraged, and then later on, after integration, it was discouraged. And so some of those middle-income, upper-middle-income people moved out of those neighborhoods, and they left poor working-class people alone to fend for themselves. And so that's sort of what you have in D.C. After Marion Barry helped to build up the middle class left, and they went to Prince George's County. They right. went to Virginia. And so we have to start trying to rebuild those communities that were here before, which were mixed income communities.
I agree with that. And that was the truth in North New Jersey, too, where I lived. There were people that lived up the street. I lived in my grandmother's house, and there were people that lived up the street from us that did so much better than we did, and it was a mixed community. Our schools, economically, not racially, but economically, yeah. It was a mixed community, and I never knew you were from New Orleans, Jeanetta. That's why I like you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite cities, and I often said that if I went to school in New Orleans, I would have never made it. I'd still be down there partying at 70 years old. Because if there's one group of people that know how to party in America, it's certainly the people in New Orleans.
Yeah.
But I spent a summer there one time. It was great as an adolescent. But let me ask you something. What do you think about ranked choice voting? It's going to be on the ballot when we vote in November, and I think it's a crazy idea.
I was, it's funny because I was listening to a candidates forum not long ago, actually, where the candidates were asked whether they supported ranked choice voting, and every candidate said no. I think it was Ward 8 that I think it was Ward 8. I'm not sure. I'm misremembering maybe. But the point is that there are the way that the ranked choice voting has been presented in this city, coupled with open primaries. If it gets on the ballot, it's going to get on the ballot not because of ranked choice voting, but because of open primaries.
Right.
And what many people are worried about is that with the ranked choice voting, it's way complicated. And
yes,
the mythology is that ranked choice voting will make it easier for African Americans and for black and brown people to get elected. Well, maybe some other places need that. We don't need that.
Right.
I think we're doing just fine with getting African Americans. I do have a problem with the fact that we don't have a Hispanic person in our council. I have a problem, a serious problem with that. I have a serious problem that we don't have a Republican or a conservative on our council.
Right.
I think those deprive us of having the kind of diverse political ideas and approaches that would make the city a better city. But I do not think ranked choice voting is the panacea that everyone is trying to sell it as.
Well, and you know, when you say that people worry about it being complicated, and when we vote in D.C. now, you can vote for two people for city council at large. And what happened in the last election is 80,000 people didn't vote for the second choice.
Right.
Because they can't wrap their heads around voting for two different people for the same office. You know, that, and if that's too complicated, imagine what it'll be to vote for three or four or five people for the same office.
Well, some of the undervoting that occurs in the at large race is deliberate.
I mean, people
are bullet voting to ensure that their candidate gets elected.
Right.
But a lot of it is what you're talking about, where people just don't know. Some of it is also that the ballot is poorly designed and they don't know to flip it over in some instances.
Right.
And so you have those. You have those factors, but I do agree with you that I think the primary reason for the undervoting is that people don't know or they can't conceive that you're electing two people for a position. You know, they just don't understand it, even though it's been that way forever.
Yes, and you know, I ran for city council at large. I had no money. There were 13 candidates. I came in one spot away from winning. I came in third instead of second. And all we put people at every polling place with T-shirts and literature that said, make your second vote count. Make your second vote count. Because we wanted to try to get people to realize that that second vote was theirs. And look, I did. We were so shocked. I was ahead of the person that won in the middle of the evening, and we were shocked by it. We were absolutely shocked by it. We had spent like $20,000 when people are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and all this stuff, and we were just shocked. So, yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, Jeanette, we're running out of time, so let me ask you, what do you want to say that I haven't asked you? What do you want to add?
Oh, I think I prefer being asked questions than to volunteer information.
Okay. Well, it just sounds like somebody that knows what they're doing. And
We did talk about the council, but I don't know that we talked about the election. There is a primary election coming up on June the 4th.
Just got my ballot, yes.
Yeah, and so the ballots are, people are start voting on May the 10th. I mean, they have the ballots, and May the 10th you can start sending in your ballots, mailing in the ballots, dropping in the ballots at the ballot boxes. Everyone should have gotten their voter guide. I think that there are some very fascinating candidates. I can't really talk specifically about races, but I will say that the Ward 2 race, I've written about that. That's the Democratic primary, the Ward 2 Democratic primary candidate, Brooke Pinto, the incumbent, is running unopposed. There are two very interesting candidates running the independent in the Democratic primary. There's the incumbent and also Rodney Red Grant, who you may remember ran in 2022 against the mayor as an independent candidate. Mm-hmm. He's now circled back and is running as a Democratic candidate against Robert White. I think it's going to be an interesting time as we look at how, you know, you started the conversation on the recall. And I do think the recall suggests that people are more animated now about the city and about the government. And so I'm looking forward to see whether that animation actually plays out in terms of the number of people who fill out their ballots and turn their ballots in or come to the polls. It'll be interesting to see whether any candidate gets a real mandate. Obviously, we know the top issue is crime in the city.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, and I hope that you're there to continue to cover it, because I really mean this, Jeanette. I read your stuff. I think it's honest and insightful, and I think that we need that in our politics today. And you know, the fact that you use the word interesting, my father always used to say that there's a Chinese curse, which is may you be born in interesting times. So yes, I think we are. We are
in interesting times right now, well, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And Jeanette Rez-Barris, thanks so much for being on my show. We always play out with a song. We dedicate it to our guest. And tonight we're going to play, of course, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, one of my favorites.
One of my favorites as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And thanks, folks. Tune in next week. We'll see you.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.